This is basically a fragment from a very long piece on it's called Democracy's Anarchy. The piece is really mostly about contemporary issues, and including problems of violence and democracy, and an attempt to theorize a radical democracy that would not be the kind of Black Cloud move argument, but something else. And in the middle of it, it has this diversion, I guess, onto these very ancient things, okay, around this concept, you know, Archaea, which is might be the world's first political concept. But I'm also interested in how it occurs in a philosophical sense before politics. So this is not going to bring into the discussion, you know, Heidegger or Derrida or Rainer Schurman, who of course would be the right person as a commentator on Heidegger. But it really stays with these phrases. There are basically two phrases from Aristotle, one from Herodotus, and the passage, the Anaximander fragment, which I spent some time on. So let me start just going straight to it. The first quotation, there is a sort of rule pertaining to those similar in birth and free. This we call political rule, where the ruler learns by being ruled, or the governor can learn by being governed. You can think of it that way. So this phrase encapsulates not only the paradoxality of democracy, but the deeper significance of what it means for society to constitute on its own and for itself a mode of political life without fixed norms and without guarantees. This mode of life is political par excellence, and democracy is its name. It is a mode that animates political life as such, the essence of human being as political animal, again Aristotle's zoon politikon. In other words, if the human animal is a political animal, it is because it refuses to consider the arche of things as natural and subjects it to interrogation. Aristotle's particular stipulation about rulers learning by being ruled has drawn voluminous commentary, but I'm arguing that there's more to the language, the Greek language itself, that might be immediately comprehensible. So we must not forget that arche means both origin and rule, much in the sense that in the English language we understand rule to pertain both to matters of governance and to matters of principle. Indeed, first principles, the essential rules of the game, of proposition, foundation, of order. The ruler, after all, is a primary figure, even in cases articulated as primus inter pares, the premier in a constitutive mechanism of ruling that presupposes the primary guardian of a set of rules that he, and it's, of course, in this patriarchal situation, so he represents. In any archaic configuration of power, the archon commands authority not only over the domain of rules that govern a society. He also embodies the point of departure of whatever trajectory such rules are to have in their implementation, whether they are to be enforced in principle or not, safeguarded for future generations of rulers and ruled, or dismantled in favor of another course of rule, another beginning. Such is obviously the essence of the figure of the patriarch, which is why even when the primordial parasite takes place, according, let's say, to Freud's tales, the patriarchal order is hardly abolished. On the contrary, in its multiplication, the authorial origin is consolidated. But when Aristotle demands that the archon must also be archomenos, ruler ruled, something else entirely takes place. The singular notion of arche is deconstituted by a corresponding alterity. In order to know how to rule, one must know how to be ruled. This is the quintessential element of autonomy. Knowledge of being ruled does not mean mere experiential accounting from the standpoint of the always ruled. In a direct sense, it means knowing the other side of rule, enabling an affirmative investment in the object of rule from a subject position that is not consumed in the typical objectification suffered by those ruled. In this respect, it provides a sort of knowledge that relativizes a ruler's presumed monopoly over the authority to determine what rule means, and in effect abolishes the presumed epistemic distinction between rulers and ruled in producing a subject of authority, of power, in a double sense. Now, this coincidence can be considered from two standpoints, and I'm going to use the two meanings, one origin, the other power. On the one hand, the ruled authorize their own position as ruled. That is, they're not ruled in the simple sense of submitting to the authority of the ruler, an authority predicated on the assumption that the ruler is also the origin of rule. They're ruled by virtue of their own decision to be ruled, which is to say, they hold the reins of interrogation, and that signification, over the terms of ruling. Who rules, why, and how? The very mode of interrogation of the rule of law. This is why this notion has nothing to do with the debilitating paradox of voluntary servitude that Etienne de la Boétie so brilliantly exposed several centuries ago, which nonetheless continues to characterize most of today's societies of consensus. The ruled who hold the reins of interrogation over the signifying framework of rule can never become servile by definition. They're motivated by a principle of self-limitation that safeguards their autonomy, their self-determination. That is why in the Athenian polis, slaves are not ruled, strictly speaking. They just execute commands. And one of the things that's very interesting people forget is that the polis in Athens were slaves. Slaves conducted the police work because they were not, they're just simply executing the legislative rules. They're not making laws. They could arrest an aristocrat without a problem if, in fact, the polis then would determine the interpretation. So the slaves, they're altogether outside the realm of ruling, not only because to be ruled means to participate in ruling, but also because ruling does not mean issuing commands in a hierarchical structure, but rather a condition of rule shared by the free and equal, which is as such, and Aristotle just is unequivocal in this quotation, political rule, he calls it politikiarchy, that in itself. By this logic, a ruler who has never known how to be ruled, a ruler who has not known the autonomy of being ruled, cannot possibly rule without abusing autonomy in favor of ruling in its name. Aristotle's injunction against such a ruler opens the way toward considering the project of autonomy as an interminable exercise of self-rule, even in the political domain of being ruled. On the other hand, now I'm coming to the second signification, Aristotle's configuration of archy also subverts the signification of ruler as primordial authority. If concurrently to rule archy signifies origin, the requisite knowledge of archomenos forbids the ruler's singular occupation of the origin of authority, introducing thus a difference at the origin, a foundational difference, as we used to say in the old days. As archomenos, a ruler can never claim to be the first and only. At most, he can acknowledge the position of archon, ruler, as a transitory moment in the process of ruling, which is a process whose ultimate beginning is unknown and irrelevant, and whose ultimate end point is incomprehensible as such, a process undertaken by society as a whole, provided society recognizes and enacts its autonomy. For an archon to recognize the archomenos as a subject position means to recognize an alterity within, which by traditional logic is impossible. What makes it possible, the capacity for self-altering, is even more far-fetched, logically speaking. It signifies a process by which alterity is internally produced, dissolving the very thing that enables it, the very thing whose existence derives meaning from being altered, from othering itself. If knowing how to be ruled is essential to ruling, no ruler can claim self-authorization, and archy can no longer constitute itself a singular origin. Authority begins already cleft and differential, open to question at the point of its constitution by virtue of the fact that both subject and object of power are coincidental positions. Each other's alterity does not disintegrate to mere opposition, but rather remains involved in a mutual complicity that exposes the whole business of ruling as a veritably anarchic condition. In this very sense, my argument is, anarchy is the arche of democracy. Now, one may object to my quick reading of this phrase of Aristotle that it's not very Aristotelian. Strictly speaking, this would be correct. By Aristotelian terms, it is a perverse reading. My conclusion, certainly, because the coincidence of ruler and ruled is no doubt what the text, the Aristotelian text, pursues. My conclusion is perverse in the simple sense that anarchy, literally the non-being of rule, which isn't to say the lack of rule or unruliness, obviously we can talk about that, would be inconceivable to Aristotle as the core signification of democracy. Though not quite bearing Plato's vehemence, because Plato explicitly identifies anarchy to be the internal and incurable illness of democracy, Aristotle would signify anarchy as the unraveling of democracy. precisely what democracy will cease to be by becoming. Again, however, the semantic multivalence of the Greek language enables a broader horizon of understanding the permutations of this concept. Given our scant knowledge of the pre-classical Greek world, the word archaea first occurs as a philosophical principle in the famed Anaximander fragment, which is itself an interpolated text, possibly written around 570 BCE, and glossed by Theophrastus, who was Aristotle's premier student, around 350 BCE. Theophrastus' commentary no longer exists, but references to it are found in Simplicius, a Neoplatonist writing in 517 AD, who produces in turn a citation of the famed fragment, in effect, a whole 1,000 years later. So, in a sense, we're kind of not knowing what we're talking about, because we, you know, scholiasts, of course, claim that the fragment is genuine. This initial philosophical use by Anaximander of a word, archae, already present in scant textual traces, going back to Homer, comes into conjunction with his introduction of a bona fide new concept that did not exist before, the concept of apeiron, or the infinite, or infinity. The tenet of my argument should be obvious. The notion of archae, origin and rule, is first used philosophically in order to identify what has no origin and no end, and over which there can be no rule. This is the infinity principle. Now, I'm not going to read the quotations in front of you to save time, but I will point out they're very, I mean, this is a very complex fragment, frankly. But I'm going to say a couple of things, just two things, and extrapolate on them. First, in this fragment, archae is infinite. This does not preclude it from being a source of all matter, of everything, in fact. Nor, however, does this mean that it is somehow external to this everything it enables, because this everything decays, is finite, and thereby returns to become source again. Source, therefore, is not Ursprung, the one and only origin, the once and for all event of creation, but an infinite space of interminably enacted beginnings of an indefinite array of things that have one thing in common: they come to an end. There is a crucial element in the meaning of apeiron that we need to remember. In Greek, literally, whatever has no peras, which is what apeiron is, has nothing, has no peras, doesn't just mean whatever has no limit, but also whatever cannot be completed. In this sense, the infinite is also incomplete. The paradoxical condition is that the incomplete infinite enables the emergence of the finite, therefore completed, an emergence that is as such a disturbance of the infinite. The finitude of existence is thus justified by the very violation of the infinite. It is this violation that inaugurates the question of justice, if you look at the fragment. In addition to signifying whatever is unlimited and incomplete, the infinite, by virtue of the literal polysemy of the word apeiron, also means whatever exceeds experience. In Greek, the word is pira. Literally, something that cannot be empirically determined, which is where we get the word empirical. In this latter sense, insofar as it cannot be empirically known, the infinite, apeiron, is not just interminable, as it came to be understood in Aristotle's day, but indeterminable, something that in itself has no telos, no finality, no termination, which is another way of saying it lacks definition, delimitation, determination. Second, but this disturbance of the infinite, indefinite, indeterminate, etc., by virtue of termination or finitude, also means that the infinite source is not omnipotent, for it is thus crossed by time. Time is what makes things or beings decay and die, and in so doing, opens infinity to their readmittance, to their return, which thus makes the infinite source simultaneously a sort of repository, a burial ground of what has come into the world and has gone out of it. Ground here, obviously metaphorical, because apeiron rests on nothing. It's groundless, right? The spatial dimension is the void. The condition of things or beings entering the world and necessarily having to go out of it constitutes in itself and without any other qualification an injustice. This is the phrase. The last part of the fragment. They give recourse to another for injustice according to the order of time. Okay. This is to say, without a brutality, that time itself constitutes an injustice, which the infinite, though an arche, can neither overrule nor alleviate. The relation between infinity and time hangs in the cosmic balance, which finite matter inevitably unsettles. For on the one hand, matter is subject to time, thereby defying the infinite. And on the other hand, matter returns to the infinite, thereby defying time. This unsettling of balance, this injustice, is life itself, the tragic life from which there is no redemption. On the basis of this impossibility of redemption ends any resemblance of this cosmological sense with views of humanity separated from the divine, fallen from grace by original sin or what have you. The Greeks gesture towards, the Greeks of this era, okay, not the Platonic ones. The Greeks gesture toward a permanent cosmological condition that cannot be repaired in some messianic sense or alleviated by some paradisial afterlife. They gesture towards an injustice of which death, which is irreparable, finitude, is both a mark and the cost of retribution insofar as it restores the matricial integrity of the infinite. This Ionian imaginary, for which finitude itself constitutes an injustice, provides dike, justice, precisely in determining that one makes one's own limits in the course of living while submitting unredemptively to the ultimate limit of death. While living, one's life is potentially unlimited. One's imagination is infinitely capacious. It partakes of the abyssal infinite, we might say. Hence the danger of committing hubris and the demand thereby that one authorizes, and I would say poeticizes, in one's own limits. This would send us back to the lectures I did. It's important to add, and about this matter I would have to write a whole other essay, or somebody would, that this astounding fragmentary thought pertaining to the core of the cosmic and articulated in just a couple of sentences is explicitly understood to be a way of speaking and thinking poetically. This is the very last phrase, putting it rather poetically. The force of poiein, what enables a society to create a world for itself and a mythic language, poetry, that makes the society fully accountable to the fact that it and no other created has created this world, is essential to understanding the peculiar significance of both tragic life and democracy. Now, in his stipulation of the substitutable nature of Archon and Archomenos, Aristotle reconfigures the stakes of Anaximander's cosmology in explicitly political terms. This cosmology echoes in his account of ruler and ruled, although I'm not, of course, suggesting that this account belongs to a pre-Socratic idiom. But the temporal distance between Anaximander and Aristotle is a matter of historical interest, but this cannot be used to bar the fecund association I'm invoking. First, because if we know anything of Anaximander, it is because of Aristotle and his students, and more important, because the power of the notion of arche in the Greek world does not wane in the least, nor does it undergo such transformation in the 300 years that separates the two philosophers as to be altogether alien. As Jean-Pierre Vernon, who is for me one of the greatest thinkers about this stuff, points out, what strikes Aristotle is the notion that infinity holds together a balance of contentious forces, so that, and now I'm quoting from Vernon, no individual element should be able to monopolize the kratos, power, and impose his domination over the world. The primacy, arche, this is still Vernon, that Anaximander grants to Apeiron, infinite, aims to guarantee the permanence of an egalitarian order in which opposing powers are balanced against one another in such a way that if one of them is dominant for a moment, it is then in its turn dominated. If anyone advances and extends itself beyond its limits, it then recedes as much as it has advanced, yielding to its opposite. That's the end of quotation. In this respect, Vernon goes on to say, infinity cannot be seen as one element among the many opposing elements of the cosmos, but precisely as the intermediary. This is a very interesting point. Precisely as the intermediary between the elements,
what mediates them and is by the same word, meson, in the middle of them. The mediating space of the elements, a limitless and abyssal terrain on which the limit and capacity for self-limitation in every element is tested, drawn and redrawn, broken, reconstituted. The limitless is a mediatory field that enables limits to be self-instituted. The very constitution of the middle is itself a groundless condition of autonomy. According to Anaximander's vision, the earth, this is not in the fragment, but from another one of his, the fragments of his, the earth exists in the midst of infinity, situated thus and sustained because of the equilibrium produced by interminably contending and opposing forces. An equilibrium that's never static, but interminably dynamic, since if any one force achieves dominance, it must be immediately destroyed by an emergent opposing force, and so on. In this infinite dynamic, the earth is otherwise, the Greek phrase is υπομηδενός κρατούμενη, that is literally held by nothing. That's what that phrase would mean, literally. But also, in some ways equally literally, beholden to no one, not dominated, κρατούμενη, by anything, therefore independent and autonomous. That is, in the midst, meson, of the infinite universe, the kratos of the earth, the power of the earth, is self-authorized dynamis. There is no better, I think, evidence of a social imaginary of the democratic polis than the political hue of this language of cosmological physics, because that's what it is at this particular juncture. Moreover, the significance of the middle, meson, in German it works the same way. The way Mittel works in, is very similar. Middle, mediation. Okay. Moreover, the significance of the middle, meson, is not only figurative as mediating space, but geometric as central space, in relation to which all elements, by virtue of the balance that they are thus always pressed upon to sustain, are equidistant from, or as Vernon, thinking politically, hastens to add, in a condition of isonomia, okay, isonomy. And I quote again from Vernon, same text. It can thus be said of the center, as of the infinite, that it represents not so much a particular point in cosmic space, an ideon, but the common mediator among all the points in space, a koinon, to which they all refer equally and from which they are all measured. End of quotation. So ideon and koinon are related to each other by a mutual irreconcilable otherness, something that cannot possibly be conveyed by their plausible translation as self-same on the one hand and collective common on the other. This incapacity of translation encapsulates the profound difference between the Athenian democratic imaginary and the imaginary of today's so-called liberal democracies, in which any notion of collective is configured by some sort of phantasmatic multiplication of the individual. Though in Anaximander's language, arche and dike, okay, dike being justice, pertain to cosmology, their political meaning is unquestionable, and it pertains to the constitutive emergence of the polis as a societal institution which takes place before it even becomes democratic in Athens, within and through the same social imaginary that enables its cosmology, because the first cities are, in fact, in Ionia, and it's obviously the things are linked. The meaning by cities, we mean the shift from tribal organization to what is of another kind that eventually we call political. A cosmology of groundless mediation and a geometry of equidistance from a central point are the essential registers that permeate all aspects of the city, from its architectural planning to the organization of its domestic space. Vernon specifically makes the argument that the centrality of the agora in Athens is not due to some economic principle, in the modern sense, the centrality of the marketplace in exchange of goods and ideas, but harkens back to the primitive circle of warriors, as described by Homer, in which the man who speaks takes a position at the center of the circle of equals and returns to the circle for the next man to step in the middle, and so on, middle here being crucial. Likewise, he argues that once the polis is instituted as a new mode of social organization, the hearth, the sacred space in every house that resides at the center as and is implanted in the earth, is reconfigured as common hearth, estia kini, and placed in the center of the agora space, now identified explicitly as a political symbol devoted to no divinity and thereby desacralized. This geometrics of meson, of mediation and middle, which irrevocably alters any understanding of arche as fixed point of origin and as primary rule, operates in another often quoted instance in Aristotle, which I have it here, it's the third one. A citizen is simply determined above all matters in sharing / participating in judgment and rule. This phrase demonstrates in the language itself not only how arche is indeed not constituted as a primary whole, that it is in fact cleft and permeated by difference, as I argued, but it is also, by virtue of that permeability, a condition of mediation. The citizen does not occupy or possess, the word in Greek would be katechin, rule or origin, but shares metechin, the rule in rule origin. In dismantling the verb etymologically, metechin, one could argue that metechin means also one exists within it, or literally, one permeates its possession, or even more precisely, one enters a medium of this possession. But it is not only this permeation / mediation that disrupts the illusion of a primordial and integral arche, or that it displaces its possession of the origin. It is also that, insofar as arche becomes a matter of share, and the word in Greek is metochi, it's still being used today to talk about
participles.
Yes, I mean the marketplace, shares. The shares, market shares, same word. It is simultaneously mediated and pluralized. Democratic arche can only be shared. If not shared, it does not exist. It sounds self-evident, but we better take seriously what it means for it not to exist. What it means for it not to exist. In addition, by virtue of the same language, democratic arche is also constitutively mediated by the transient community that shares in power. The very institutions of isonomia and isigoria being the word for equal speech, signify and actualize the mediation of arche achieved by the sharing of power. Insofar as one, here one I mean absolute singular one, cannot occupy katechin this arche, which is not to say that no one occupies this arche, one, in the generic sense, anyone, in personal and substitutable singular, traverses metechin this arche. The arche becomes a shared space of mediation that thereby disrupts the constitution or reconstitution of absolute singular, that is to say, literally monarchical rule or origin. We thus reach the paradoxical situation by modern logic, where what begins is already in the midst of what exists. A point of departure and governing principle is permeated by forces that can never be accounted for one by one, but together form the abyssal point of emergence, the opening in the infinite that creates this midst in what exists. But also, what exists is as such, if this can even be said, indeterminable, impossible to subject to any singular origin, any singular reason for being, because it too exists within the infinite. The only thing that can be said about what exists is that it exists so as to cease existing. Or rather, this is the only way to determine that something exists, that its existence is finite. Only insofar as it has a definite telos and can one understand that what exists has an arche, beginning. Finitude is the only rule arche of existence. I'm playing with the arche of democracy, anarchy as arche of democracy. Okay. This I'm kind of getting along, almost near getting to Herodotus, and that will be the end. This orientation may be called philosophical as a profound attempt to create meaning out of meaninglessness, while neither denying meaninglessness nor seeking to transcend it. But it is profoundly political, not only because it belongs to the social imaginary institution of the polis, but because it expresses an elemental struggle against heteronomous determination beyond the strictly physical realm. Because in the physical realm, there's no doubt heteronomy, right? And we, as I said, with this gravity, for example. We can think of this another way. If in the first instance Anaximander's fragment entails a specific conceptualization of physis nature, in the last instance, as it becomes comprehensible in a specific historical frame, it also conceptualizes a certain nomos. Physis, let us recall, is not a state of things. It is not nature as a given in the way that modern thought, moral, religious, or scientific has configured it. It is literally a condition of emergence, because the verb feeing means to sprout, to search forth, out of an indeterminate abyssal infinite, which cannot be quite called source, at least not as Ursprung. Physis is not a state of things as they are, but an interminable flux of generation and degeneration. The word is thought out, which is here in the fragment. How is it translated? It's a degeneration, right? Literally a dynamic of living and, of course, dying being. This dynamic shows that physis bears in itself a nomos, a mode by which the cosmos is regulated and balanced, by which justice is achieved. The ordinance of time, kata tou chronou tixin in the fragment, expresses the necessity, kata tou chreon, of finitude, which thereby preserves the possibility of interminable generation from the matrix of the infinite. The injustice does not reside in the struggle between the infinite and the finite, the indeterminate and the determined, as if they are two polarities as different universes. The struggle takes place within the infinite. What is determined to be, to live and die, emerges determined within the interminable and indeterminable to be, à être. The paradoxical figure of the ontological injustice of death being at the same time a reconstitution of the order of the infinite, therefore a gesture of justice against the injustice of existence disrupting the infinite fold, suggests a social imaginary that takes irrevocable death as the ultimate limit of living being, the only untranscendable limit that thereby frees life from any other imposed limits. Now, limits, we can think of limits as determinations, okay? Heteronomy is thus removed from the realm of necessity in the course of one's life. Its one and only place is in death. In other words, limits or determinations in the course of one's life are open to becoming a matter of self-knowledge, self-determination, autonomy, in the strict sense of determining the question of what is nomos in one's conditions of living. Now, later on in the Politics, Aristotle reiterates his understanding of the undoing of archaea, singularity, and primacy by explicitly connecting democracy to the institution of existential liberty, and the word in Greek, eleftheria. Against all inherited notions that the concept of individual liberty emerges in Enlightenment, individualism, and liberalism, one finds in Aristotle that the liberty of living as one likes, to zin os vuletetis, this is the Greek word, the liberty of living as one likes, for to live not as one likes is precisely the condition of being a slave, is an essential element of democratic arche. Living as one likes, as one wants, would be a good way to also translate it, living as one wants, as a condition of being, is expressed politically in the desire not to be ruled by anyone. This quotation I haven't actually written down, but it is, I'm not reading the Greek, but I am translating it. From there arises the desire for not being ruled indeed by no one. Out of living as one wants, out of that arises the desire for not being ruled indeed by no one. Or if that's not possible, to rule and be ruled in turn, he says. In other words, the necessity of sharing rule, of ruling as the practice of knowing how to be ruled, is predicated on the desire not to be ruled at all. This is really a very, very important point. However, it depends on the recognition that this desire is possible only as an existential desire, the prerequisite of an ontological freedom, since the coexistence of free citizens that makes up the polis makes some sort of institutional rule necessary. We can also think of it in reverse. Refusal to be ruled existentially can only be actualized politically in sharing rule, in knowing how to be ruled. This only makes sense if we abolish our preconditioned idea that being ruled means having no power. In democracy, being ruled means having power. Not as some sort of clientelist electorate or the alleged agency of public opinion, as happens routinely in contemporary liberal oligarchies, but precisely insofar as the decision to be ruled is made autonomously, in full cognizance of the fact that this is a decision made by the plurality of rulers, since rule, or more precisely self-rule, is shared by all. Obviously, there's a lot of predicates here in order for this to happen. The relation between ruler and ruled is therefore not simply dialectical. It belongs to the order of coincidence. I can talk more about what I mean by coincidence. I've been using that concept for some years. It is by this logic of coincidence that I speak of anarchy, to return to my first thesis, anarchy is the archy of democracy. The term literally means the impossibility of fully constituted or once and for all constituted archy, anarchy, right? Both as point of origin and as point of governance. It does not mean the refusal of governance or the refusal of principle. At least not when it comes to politics in a democracy. In Herodotus, there is the famous episode of the three Persian princes who are discussing the form of power that the Persian kingdom must have in the wake of the reign of Cambyses. As has been amply pointed out, Herodotus is here enacting an allegorical exercise to discuss different modes of politics. I mean, the three princes each represent a particular mode. This is a theatrical exercise, and despite the fact that the actors are Persians, the dramaturgy is Greek. And so is the matter enacted. It's inconceivable that three Persian princes would conduct a debate over which political mode would be the best to succeed the death of the king. Moreover, we know that Herodotus made a sojourn in Athens around 447-443, which is right in the middle of Periclean times. And we may just as well imagine that this specific scene would have been publicly performed for the benefit and interrogation of the Athenians. It is really an Athenian way of thinking. The theatrical debate as to which mode of rule was preferable, the three-art democracy, oligarchy, monarchy, itself deserves a close reading, for it bears considerable rhetorical and political subtlety. Most striking, however, is the concluding phrase by Otanes, the advocate of democracy of the three, right? Who, upon facing the agreed decision by the majority, they draw lots. They vote. They draw lots, I'll tell you later why. Most striking, however, is the concluding phrase by Otanes, who, upon facing the agreed decision by majority that the preferable solution is monarchy, it's 2-1, basically, decides to withdraw his name from the process of succession to the throne. That's where the lots are drawn. It's who's going to succeed, because they're all going to be monarchs. By famously declaring, ute archin, ute arches te thelo, I want neither to be ruled nor to be ruled. This phrase in Herodotus is often identified as an expression of anarchist sentiment. And I've had this argument with Etienne Balibar about this. We actually believe that's the case. I really disagree. This is absurd in any strict political sense. I take it to be the mere expression of the desire to be exempted from the political, literally an option to withdraw into the private sphere. Otanes deliberately opts out of any participation in government, and in return, he and his family gain a sort of asylum, a freedom in a state of exception established by a certain rule, a rule of the game, a convention, but a rule of another nonetheless. For even if it is Otanes' own decision to opt out, the survival of the agreement he brokers is henceforth predicated on the goodwill of another, the one who will come to rule, the monarch. In the discussion that takes place before the agreement, Otanes defends the option of democratic politics, not using the name democracy, however, but the name isonomia. And I would argue that isonomia works much like the coincident isonomic archy of ruler-ruled. In that respect, it's linked to democracy, because the ruler and rule have to be in an isonomic relation in order for this to work, obviously. His critique of monarchy is precisely that it is situated in a hubristic relation to the law. By occupying the law absolutely, it exceeds, violates, and thus annihilates the law. There is indeed a subtle but definitive shift in the language in Herodotus, from arche to nomos, monarchy to isonomy. For democracy is qualitatively other to monarchy, not merely by the fact that rule is exercised by the multitude, plethos, as opposed to the rule of the one, but that rule, arche, is subject to law, nomos, according to the essential significance of the verb nemin, as we know, dividing, apportioning, mediating, sharing. Otanes' final decision, however, is ultimately a rejection of the democratic politics he espouses, for no community, no polis, and no demos can be constituted on the basis of refusal to rule and be ruled. It is, moreover, a blatant violation of isonomy in that Otanes' decision pertains to himself only. His family is literally his property, so property him. It is, if you will, an option for ideon over koinon, to come back to Vernon, thereby positing the exclusive privilege of just one, a monologic position that is, strictly speaking, monarchic, even if in name anarchic. So, to conclude, in other words, whatever is Otanes' overt naming of his decision, his position is actually not anarchic, because anarchy, in the way I'm defining it, can only exist against the providence of the one, the singularity of arche as origin and rule. Moreover, as a political position, anarchy is not a matter of personal desire. It is an investment in a specific signification of arche, whereby the business of ruling is a plural, shared, yet contentious affair. Anarchy can never be linked to an apolitical position, to the voiding of arche, whereby the business of ruling is left to the others. In that sense, too, anarchy is the arche of democracy.